And now I'm with Rick Sterling. He's an independent journalist in the San Francisco Bay Area. He also writes for antiwar.com, LA Progressive, and Dissident Voice. And he's been covering Syria quite thoroughly. So, Rick, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Nice to be here, Brendan.
Well, we have a new article for you that caught the attention of a number of people. It's called The High Human Cost of Syria Sanctions. And I happened to catch this one in Dissident Voice. It's just from a few days ago, less than a week ago. This article is about what the sanctions on Syria, organized primarily by the US, what they did and what they've enabled. And so we know right now that there is celebration over the fact that President Trump has removed the sanctions or some sanctions on Syria. Before we come to understanding that better, I thought we should perhaps start with why the sanctions were put in the first place. So, Rick, can you tell us what was the motivation and the circumstances behind the United States imposing sanctions on Syria in the first place?
Yeah. Well, there's actually a long history of United States sanctions on Syria, and the crux of the reason that the US has imposed sanctions on Syria is because they have an independent foreign policy and they've been bucking the demands. They've been resisting the demands of the United States and the West, and especially Israel. The first time sanctions were imposed is way back in 1979. After Egypt came to an accord with Israel in the late 1970s, the US and Israel wanted Syria to do the same. And they put pressure on Syria to come to an agreement to recognize Israel and to stop their support of Palestinian rights. And Syria resisted under Hafez al-Assad at that time. They maintained their position, and the United States put the first sanctions at that time. Then, after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, Syria was became the home to about 1 million Iraqi refugees, and they helped that many people survive after they had to flee their homeland. Syria was a very staunch opponent of the US and the Western, the so-called Coalition of the Willing invasion of Iraq, and they supported the resistance in Syria as well. So again, the United States put more pressure, more sanctions on Syria. And then, of course, and then later on, the Lebanese resistance movements were getting increasingly successful, and they expelled Syria in 2006. And then in 2007, Nancy Pelosi went to Damascus and more or less threatened Bashar al-Assad that if Syria did not recognize Israel, if they did not cease and desist on their support for the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance, that there would be consequences. And then a few years after that, Hillary Clinton again pressured Syria. And then it was just in 2011, in March, in the spring of 2011, that the insurrection in Syria began. There's an interesting quote from a former French foreign minister who recounts and who describes how he knew this was coming years in advance, because 2 years before the uprising in Syria in 2011, he was in London, and his UK colleagues were telling him about that they were preparing something in Syria, and they tried to persuade him and the French government to go along at that time. So he said that they were preparing people to invade Syria, and indeed they did in the March of 2011. Immediately, the when the conflict began in the spring of 2011, part of the war on Syria was a media war. So there were all sorts of reports of atrocities by Assad, and a lot of these were concocted. There was the media reported that there was just peaceful demonstrations in Damascus, and the Syrian army and the Syrian police were repressing and killing peaceful protesters, when in reality there were violent protesters in the mix right from the start. Now it's true that there were peaceful protesters. That's undoubtedly true. But in the mix, when you throw in the violent protesters as well, that changes the dynamics tremendously. And then subsequently, the United States ambassador admitted that they had people with rifles on the roofs of neighboring buildings, and they were shooting at police. Suppose his explanation was they were shooting at the police to keep them from attacking the protesters, but that's very dubious. So.
Well, Rick, I mean, you've brought up a number of issues here, which are all very fascinating. It's clear that, yes, there were not only violent demonstrators, if you could call them that, interspersed with other demonstrators, but of course, there were sectarian chants and demands from the very beginning among certain parties. And the kind of actions by violent people provoked a crackdown that would have happened in almost any country in which the state had to respond to shootings and other acts. But you mentioned that this is happening in 2011 because Syria did not comply with what was being asked of them. So I think in your article, you referred to it specifically, as you did here, that Syria was asked to stop supporting resistance activities in West Asia. So they were told, stop supporting Lebanese resistance, stop supporting Palestinians. And I guess if Syria had just complied with what they had been asked to do in 2010, 2011, 2012, these occurrences would not have taken place.
That is correct. That's absolutely correct, and we can see the proof now when the Ahmed El-Sharaa, who's the leader of the Al-Qaeda branch in Syria, and leads the government there now, is making moves to normalize relations with Israel. And immediately the West is lifting all the sanctions on Syria, and President Trump just a week or 10 days ago announced that the US was going to lift the sanctions. So I support lifting the sanctions. The Syrian people have suffered ever since 2011, especially. They've suffered tremendously. But the sanctions should never have been imposed in the first place.
Yes. So if we could look at some mechanics of this, I understand there were multiple phases of sanctions. And as you say, this is part of a design. And you mentioned the United States had objectives early on, 2010, 2011. And I think we're starting to really finally see the big picture of what they wanted in terms of the new Middle East that's now being created, what's emerging in terms of the alliance between the US, the Gulf states, Israel, and this new Syria under Jolani, this kind of normalization. So there was the media aspect to this, there was the military aspect to this, and there was the sanctions, which were ever present throughout the conflict, weakening Syria. At the beginning, the sanctions were not quite identical to what was taking place later. So I'm just wondering if you can tell us, what were these sanctions like initially? What was being done to Syria in terms of restrictions of goods or trade?
Well, there were sanctions, but they were not extreme. They did not have secondary sanctions. That is, and when the U.S. When they imposed secondary sanctions with the Caesar sanctions in 2019, what that did was it said anybody, any company, any country, any individual who violates our sanctions or the U.S. sanctions is going to be subject to penal penalties. And these are not trivial penalties. There's one example is the BNP Paribas, which is a very big French bank. It, for violating U.S. sanctions, it was fined $9 billion. This back some years ago, but it just shows how serious the secondary sanctions are. So the U.S. claims the right to not just say we don't want to do business with Syria, we're not going to do business with Syria. They're through the CSAR sanctions, through the secondary sanctions, they said nobody can do business with Syria.
Now, the CSAR sanctions, I understand that came later, or that the sanctions regime against Syria was intensified throughout the conflict and at a later time. Your article talks about how Syria initially had made military successes against this operation to change the government. And so it was able to defeat various proxy groups, winning battles, but we see that it lost the war. You're arguing that sanctions played a key role in this. So, can you tell me or can you tell us how Syria came from winning battles initially to being weakened by the sanctions?
Right. They were, of course, the country was tremendously disrupted by the war and by the conflict, with a tremendous amount of damage, and so forth. But I made numerous trips to Damascus and Homs and other parts of Syria, and it was very interesting, and it was very surprising to go there and see, restaurants and coffee houses and bars, and there was a thr it was thriving in the day and night in so many places, and there was a positive mood among the people, and they were confident that they were going to prevail over the sectarian extremists. But later on, when the CSAR sanctions were imposed in 2019, what happened was that so much crippled the economy. Through the CSAR sanctions, the Syria Central Bank, and now this is a semi-socialist country, so the Syrian Central Bank is crucial. So many the state is not just involved in building schools and hospitals, but it's got a stake in businesses and industries, and it's it's everywhere. Through the CSAR sanctions, the Syria Central Bank was claimed to be a quote money laundering institution, and so that set that made it impossible for any bank anywhere in the world or any financial institution to do business with it. And now, at the same time, the U.S. was putting the screws on the Lebanese economy, where Lebanon was traditionally the largest trader with Syria. Syria and Lebanon were the biggest importers and exporters to each other's country. They couldn't do business anymore. So the only business that could be conducted was in the black market, was off the books. That, of course, can lead to all sorts of corruption. But the bottom line is that there was a positive spirit in the country, and there was a confidence because the Syrian army was defeating the jihadists. They were really clear. But with the imposition of the CSAR sanctions and the crushing of the economy, right away, I mean, the Syrian pound went from being worth 600, there were 650 Syrian pounds to the dollar, and in just like half a year, there were thousands. It lost 90% of its value with imports. So there was, I remember chatting with a fellow who was, he was on the street. He had a little blanket in front of him, and he was trying to sell some products just to make a dollar any way he could, and he said to me, Syria used to be the best country on earth, and now look at us.
Well,
They
Rick, that's
were,
quite a contrast. If I may interrupt, that you have
yeah.
spoken about that in the article itself. For those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Unusual Sources. I'm Brendan Stone, co-host, speaking with Rick Sterling, investigative journalist, whose recent article, "The High Human Cost of Syria Sanctions," was featured in Dissident Voice just a few days ago. And Rick, in this article, towards the beginning, you mentioned that before the conflict began, Syria was actually a pretty decent place to live. You point out it had free education, free healthcare, no national debt. It was largely self-sufficient in energy and food. So this is a country that had a degree of economic sovereignty. Undoubtedly, this is one of the reasons why it was targeted so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a secular state as well. All faiths and all ethnicities were considered equal, and that was part of the identity of Syria. And of course, it was the jihadists who waged war were sectarian. They hated the Alawites. They hated the Christian. They hated the Druze, and that was a basis. Their slogan was Christians to Beirut, Alawites to the grave. And in the last couple of months, there have been numerous massacres and atrocities where hundreds and even thousands of Alawites and Christians have been massacred.
I've seen more videos of massacres filmed by the perpetrators themselves, ethnic cleansing, massacres, and so forth in the countryside, than I saw in the entirety of the Syrian conflict, 14, 15 years of war. It's really tearing the social fabric of Syria. I don't know how Jolani is going to be able to govern given the variety of ethnic groups that have been targeted. But it's also evident that when people come to, they rush in to defend this new government, they'll say things like, well, it has to normalize with Israel and become like the Gulf states, normalize with the United States so they can have economic prosperity. So they can, the food can be flowing again, the jobs. Well, didn't they have these things before someone put a war onto them?
Absolutely, they did. It was a very comfortable place to live, and there's a United Nations report that's just come out in the last few weeks that talks about that, how Syria was a middle income country. It had no national debt because they have agriculture, they have energy resources. They have the wheat growing area of the northeast, and it was not just the sanctions. Coupled with the sanctions was the occupation of the wheat and energy producing parts of the country, and they were occupied by U.S. troops who supported a proxy secessionist army. So you had not just ISIS and Al-Qaeda. You had the U.S. Army and you had Israel supporting the jihadists. You had jihadists or terrorist factions supported by a vast array of countries. And of course, they paid for the recruiting, the traveling, the training, the weaponization. And of course, there were even some Canadians who were deceived into and brainwashed and deceived into going and dying in Syria.
Well, certainly the results of this campaign are nothing to celebrate. It is just a horror show, whatever you read about Syria these days, from the things happening on the ground to people to the actual policy, domestic and foreign, being carried out by what can generously be called a government now under Jolani. And we see every day there's some new capitulation, some new sellout of Palestinians, whether it's one group or another that's being arrested, to various restrictions that are being placed on the operation of Palestinians and Palestinian groups within Syria. So it's a very unpleasant situation. We can, of course, be happy, as many have said, that the sanctions are being lifted. We have been calling for the lifting of sanctions in terms of solidarity activists, anti-war activists. We have conducted events against sanctions for years and years. But we can see how politicized they are, that only now they are being lifted. You pointed out that the United States was sitting on Syria's oil and wheat fields. So it had placed all these restrictions, preventing Syria from utilizing its agriculture, its oil, and oil revenue. It was being sanctioned, it was being attacked, and it was being diplomatically blocked, and so forth. And it seems that these are all now gradually being lifted now that the United States has accomplished its objectives in that country.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I think the Gulf and Turkey and the West is hopeful that they can stabilize the situation and prevent Syria becoming a failed state, as it happened in Libya and Sudan and Somalia and other countries that have been the target for regime change by the US. I think they're trying to prevent that from happening, but whether they're going to be able to or not is an open question, because you can't put a lipstick on a pig. The Al-Qaeda a leadership, as much as it's being guided by the West and it's being coached by the West, and of course the atrocities did not get anywhere near the publicity that they should have in the West. So they're covering up a lot of the bad things that are happening, a lot of the insecurity, the fear, the people afraid to go out at night. That's being covered up in the West, and they're putting a gloss on it. Of course, the Syrian people they're desperate after so many years of war, so many years of hunger, electricity 2 hours a day. Can you imagine what it's like being in a country that's got hot summers and there's only electricity a couple of hours a day? So your food, there's no way to keep food in a refrigerator, and in the cold winters, there's no heat. So they've been immiserated for years and years, and so naturally they are the Syrian population is hopeful that at last their nightmare is going to be over. But meanwhile, the sectarianism, the abandonment of support for the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance, the people in power there are very much against the ideals of most Syrians. So there it's pr it I think they're It's realistic to think, and there's a real danger of very dark days ahead, not just happy days, but on the contrary, it's going to be there's a lot of danger in the days ahead.
Unfortunately, that seems to be the case, and it's likely that things are going to get worse before they ever get better. And in terms of rebuilding, the United States seemed to put in some effort when they destroyed Iraq to then try and rebuild it. That didn't work out so much, and I don't know if they've ever tried that hard since. We'll see. At least they're removing restrictions on Syria, but that government, as you say, can't really represent the population. I guess the lesson here, or one of the lessons, is that you can't allow the United States to utilize its own version of international institutions to coerce countries. It put sanctions on Syria, among other restrictions, which of course did break the country, broke the government, broke the morale of the population, and allowed these foreign-backed entities to take power. So, it seems as long as the United States is able to cut people off from money, from the banking systems, from having things imported into the country or being able to export their products, etc., it's going to be able to bully smaller countries in that fashion, even if they haven't had that kind of success with countries like Russia or China.
That's exactly right, Brendan. And that's another bad thing about what's happened, because it's given the U.S. The confidence that yes, sanctions can work. People used to say, well, sanctions don't work. Look at how long they've had sanctions on Cuba, and Cuba's never had a regime change. What we've seen in Syria is the sanctions did work. They did work at breaking the will of the people, at demoralizing the people. There was another aspect to this, which is important, which is that while the sanctions were being imposed on Damascus and 75% of Syria, the province, the Idlib province that was controlled by the jihadists, was exempt from the sanctions. They were being nourished, and conditions in Idlib were improving dramatically, in sharp contrast, as well as in the northeast, in the area dominated by the U.S. and their proxy force. They weren't subject to sanctions, so it was the conflict was frozen, and there was the belief that Iran, Russia, and Turkey were going to come up with some kind of a solution that could find a settlement that would be good for the long haul and would appease some of the opposition. But meanwhile, the opposition was being nurtured, it was being trained, it was there was investment pouring into Idlib province, while Damascus and greater Syria was being strangled to death. So it was a very bad thing, and it's dangerous now because Washington has seen they're no doubt chalking this up as a success for sanctions.
Yes, well, I think your investigations into this matter have helped everyone understand why there's what they call growing multilateralism in the sense of many countries seeking to move farther away from the United States, farther away from the institutions and banking and currency systems it controls, so that they can not be coerced to the degree that a country like Syria was. And perhaps we'll see some effects of that as time marches forward.
Yeah, definitely. I hope so. And a lot of people don't know the United Nations General Assembly has been very, very clear on this, and they denounce sanctions, or what they call unilateral coercive measures. They denounce U.S. sanctions as violating international law and the UN Charter. They call and they're saying they need to be rescinded, all of them.
Well, I think we need to respect the UN Charter and or organizations that fulfill that function in the world today. So, Rick, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for being on the program with us today.
Yeah, very nice to be here, Brendan.
And that was Rick Sterling, author and researcher. Be sure to look up his articles on Dissident Voice, LA Progressive, antiwar.com, and elsewhere.